Hello.
Hi.
Welcome back to Life of Bi. A podcast about bisexuality.
You said that so sheepishly.
I know.
A podcast about sexuality?
I lost confidence.
Yeah.
I lost confidence.
That's what happens, guys, if a queers label their own podcast.
Yeah.
A few years later, you're like, that was so gruff.
Yeah. Guys, I'm recovering from losing my voice. I lost my voice completely for a couple of days.
You're always recovering from losing your voice.
Whenever we do this podcast, I'm always ill.
You're either losing your voice or in recovery from losing your voice. It's just never in a state.
I went on vocal rest for 2 days. I didn't speak. I had to like sort of gesture to
you
Mary.
Did speak. I had a really fun game. Because I don't know if you know this, but Elle is a massive pedant. And obviously we live together. And I discovered that the way to make Elle come out of vocal rest, we were working this entire day together and they were attempting to not talk to me. But all I had to do was say something wrong on purpose and they would speak to correct me.
I am toxic. I'm toxic.
And I knew you would.
It was incredible. It's true.
It's a very fun game.
I was just doing
all of the things that I know Elle finds most annoying about how I speak.
Yeah. It worked.
Like.
Which is why I still haven't got my voice properly back. Thanks.
Oh, yeah. That's definitely my fault.
Yeah, 100%. Anyway. We're back on the podcast.
Today we've made time for it. Should we just set the scene?
Yeah.
As we were setting up, Elle started laughing because she was like, I don't know if any other podcasters set up like this. As in, I'm topless right now. Yeah. Well, I now have a dressing gown on, but we were setting up.
I just looked at you again properly. Mary's in the middle of dyeing their hair. So they've got like a Jimmy Neutron bright red, like flame sticking up from the top of their head. You look absolutely mental.
It's going to be good.
I've got wet hair. I'm in my underwear.
This is how we're squeezing it in. And sports shorts.
You're still wearing your knee supports.
I just like to feel supported. Anyway, that's the scene set. And we've literally got this period of time while my dye is developing to introduce this episode to you.
But excitingly, we have a different kind of format today.
Yeah.
Because we're going to play you a long form interview with a really interesting, cool person.
Called Rob Cohen. Who you might know if you're an avid listener to bisexual podcasts. You'll know him because his podcast, Two Bi Guys, predates ours by years.
They're experts.
Is incredibly established and actually intimidatingly organised and good.
And for some reason, Rob reached out to us in like not last November.
Yeah, and then we didn't see the email for another 3 months.
So
because
of course
we're terrible at checking our emails.
Yeah, so we interviewed him about a new book he has coming out, which actually came out last year, but because we're so bad at timekeeping.
Also, you might not have heard about it. It's called Bisexual Married Men.
Stories of Relationships, Acceptance and Authenticity.
And as you might guess from the title, its focus is all about bisexual married men.
Which is so interesting.
Like, Rob reached out to, just interviewed a few bisexual married men about their experiences. So it's sort of like it really appeals to us because it's like an interview based piece of work. Like it's like our shows or anything else that we do. But it was so nice to meet him, wasn't it?
It was so lovely to meet him. He's one of those people that you look at and smile.
It was like
such a lovely open face. It was great. It was so great. And we're so excited to play you this interview. We hope you enjoy it. So before we hand over to past us talking to Rob, we just wanted to do a quick plug for our other work.
Yeah, a fairly involved plug, actually.
Yeah, actually.
So if you haven't heard about it already, or seen it already, some of you have seen it already.
Some of you have, and that was lovely.
Our latest theatre show called The Last Show Before We Die,
which we did talk about in the last podcast,
is coming back to the Yard Theatre, where it was in January, before it goes to Bristol Old Vic, the Western Studio in Bristol Old Vic, for another 2 weeks.
16th of April to 27th of April.
That's very impressive.
Off the top of my head.
And we just want to tell you a little bit about the show.
Mm-hmm.
So the show actually was created or first seeded at the same time as we were making this podcast.
Yeah, because if you remember, we moved in together in Margate so that we could make this podcast.
In 2021.
And thus began a slippery, slippery slope in which we got...
You can say, sick of each other.
Well, that was what was on the tip of my tongue, but we didn't really.
No, that's
there were moments
like,
of that.
That's like the like narrative edge of it. I would say we did brilliantly well living together.
We did.
But, and we did make the podcast.
Yeah, we did.
So
we
that
did
was hugely successful.
I mean, look at us now.
But also it's an incredibly intense thing to move to a new place. About what was it? Did we get locked down a week after
yeah.
or something? We
yeah.
basically went to a new place and instantly got locked down.
And we were,
so then couldn't see anyone.
Yeah, we were each other's only thing.
Only thing.
We were each other's only thing.
We were each other's only thing. Like fun person, work person. We just saw each other
constantly. I mean, everyone has a story like that from lockdown, right?
But they're just not normally working with them as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd say. And I also think the fact that we didn't know anyone around us or
yeah,
the place
we
that we
new,
were in.
Exactly. We couldn't make new friends.
There were loads of levels of newness and isolation, I'd say.
Yeah. So anyway, that was a kind
that
of...
That took a toll.
Yeah, that I would say is a petri dish to,
yeah.
for breeding germs.
For breeding germs and existential
friendship
thoughts.
Germs. Yeah.
Which is where the last show before we die came from, because it's about endings.
Yeah.
And I think in Margate, we were faced with the fact that like theatres might never open again. And so you start to think about the end of
uh-huh.
your career or the end of your friendship. And you're also like, should we do this anymore? Working together on
is
the podcast is so intense while we live together. Yeah, exactly. It's sustainable.
Yeah.
And the show is born from those that fear and dread.
Yeah.
And then in 2022, we started how we always begin theatre shows,
mm-hmm.
Which is with interviewing people, except this time we had quite a specific... agenda in mind, which was to interview people that would have more expertise or experience of endings than we do.
Yeah, so that led us to interviewing your granddad
mm-hmm.
and his and
Cara.
His wife's carer,
mm-hmm.
your grandma's carer, not just his wife, and a climate activist,
a therapist,
my auntie who also works with old people.
Who's also had a divorce.
Yep, who had an acrimonious divorce, I think it's fair to say. Hope you're okay with me saying that, auntie, if you're listening.
A midwife,
a yep. different kind of ending that.
Basically just people that had done endings.
People who'd left the country they were born in.
True.
To come and settle in the UK.
And then we made a weird show from it, which is quite hard to explain, to be honest.
Yeah.
But it's based on these verbatim interviews. It also involves dance and singing. I wonder if, you know, the people that listen to this podcast who haven't seen our shows, they've got no idea whether or not it's any good.
Yeah.
They must think, I don't know if these people can dance or sing.
Mary, I also don't know if I can dance.
I don't know if I can sing.
You can sing.
You can dance.
Thanks, babe. Also, I hope that the people listening who have seen it do think it was good.
Yeah, anyway, is that it for the plug?
I think that's it. We just wanted to mention
our director really wants to talk about it more, but it's quite hard to talk about.
Well, I think it's difficult.
It's about our relationship as well.
Yeah, it's difficult to talk about it because it's our work. It's about our relationship. It's a very personal show. And also, we have to do the job of selling it. And we're not... It's like, okay, this is how we link it to Rob, right? So Rob contacted us... for us to interview him
yes.
about the book, right? But when we're talking about our show, it's just us two and we don't know how to answer questions about it because we're only talking to each other.
And sometimes when people ask me to describe the show, I just find myself like listing the composite parts and hoping that they have the imagination and faith to put them together in a way that looks flattering in their imagination's eye.
You know? We could use some words that people have described it as. One that jumps to mind is batshit.
Yeah, that's it. That's
it's
what
really
I can think
the
of.
Only one I can think of. The point is, we're going to be in Bristol for 2 weeks at the end of April,
and we'd love to see any of you that haven't made it down already or would like to see it, that'd be great.
Because we don't know how many more times we're going to perform this show because it's about endings.
And make sure you come and say hi afterwards. Don't be shy.
Yeah,
we're very approachable. I always look approachable.
Mary got recognised in Athens the other day.
Isn't that fucking crazy?
Can you believe that? Okay, that's enough.
Enough navel gazing. Please come along to the show if you feel like it.
Yeah, and tell your mates if you have seen it, because that really helps us out.
Yeah.
Okay, right. Now we're handing over to our past selves, talking to Rob Cohen of Two By Guys.
Yeah. Do you want to just introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, hi, I'm Robert Brooks Cohen. I host the Two By Guys podcast, which we've been doing for about 5 years. And when I say we, it's now just me. There were two By Guys. And Alex, my co-host, has gone on to a job at the Trevor Project. He's doing great work there, but he didn't have time to do the frivolous stuff that I'm doing. We came together at this bi discussion group in New York, and he had identified as gay before bi. I had identified as straight. So we came at it from like different directions, but then just really clicked in the worldview. And so we did the podcast. You can listen to the podcast. And then the book sort of came out of the podcast because I realized that so many of our listeners were bi married men. And we were, you know, we were one of the, at the time we started, we were one of the only podcasts really focusing on male bisexuality. And, you know, we talk about everything and we have women guests on and non-binary guests, but like there was, we just noticed there were fewer resources for bi men and even higher percentage of bi men are closeted than bi women. And like, that was what I realized is like, there's so many, especially men who already were in a relationship or marriage, maybe a little older generations, who never really had the chance to come out because bisexuality wasn't known to them or understood at the time, or the stigma was even bigger 10, 20 years ago. So there's just so many guys, like I'm 38. Like I think there's so many guys around my age and older that are in marriages and are starting to realize they're bi now, but didn't do that sooner or couldn't. And so, yeah, so I know the book is like a very specific, narrow thing, bisexual married men, and it's bi men married to women. And I explain in the intro that like, I don't think that's a more valid experience or a more interesting experience or anything like that. I just think that it's a huge group. It's one of the biggest groups in the queer community and also one of the most hidden. And there are so few resources for this group specifically. So that's when you talk about the intro, that's sort of like what I lay out, like, why did I write this book? And I hope to write more. I hope to tell more stories of different types of bi people and queer people. But yeah, that's kind of why I started here, because there's the biggest discrepancy between the number of people with this identity and the amount of stories that are told about them.
Well, yeah, your argument when you start is so strong. As you say, you're just like convinced, you're like, oh, I didn't know this was a problem, but this is a problem. I'm glad someone's sorting it out.
Especially your use of the Kinsey scale and the Klein scale and things that come afterwards. And you use it as such a helpful kind of way to look at where people might fall in the cracks. And like Mary said, the way you build it is really, really like impressive and rigorous with the data. Because I was so shocked by that. Frankly, yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, bi people are majority of the community. To drop a couple of quick ones, like we're 57% of the queer community, but then we're also the least likely to be out. I think bi women are about 20-something percent out, and bi men are like 12% out, 14% out. It varies, and hopefully it's getting better. But like, also, this is another statistic that may be changing, but 88% of bi people currently end up with a partner of a different gender. So most bi people end up in a quote straight passing or straight appearing relationship. And that's just like it's difficult for people once you realize you're queer to then be like in this relationship where people assume it's straight. And so that's like, I explore that a lot in the book.
I was interested to know, obviously we're, well, both AFAB started the podcast as two women, you know, things change. And
I love it.
Yeah. And it took us a while to, we did like one episode or like, was it two or one dedicated to men? Cause we were suddenly like, this is a distinct experience, but we don't really know why or how. Mm-hmm. So I wondered if you wanted to talk to us a bit about, like, I guess how you think masculinity specifically impacts the bi married experience, like what it adds on to the bi married experience.
Yeah, well, there's so many things around this intersection that we could talk about. And yeah, like, I think to a certain extent, the first thing that comes to mind is like, there's a conflict here with like what people think of as masculinity or like sort of the box we're supposed to fit into. And there's a conflict with bisexuality because there's a perception that being attracted to the same gender is emasculating or is a feminine quality you're losing your masculinity to sort of explore that or to be open about it. And so that's like the very first thing that just leads people to push this away and deny it for a long time. And like, but then what I have found doing the book is like, and this is what Shiri Eisner talks about a lot, is that like bisexuality gives people a good opportunity to step away from like dominant masculinity and dominant like culture in general and just like see things from a new angle. And so often what I found with the guys I interviewed was that like once they recognize their own sexual fluidity, they start to look at their masculinity differently and look at their gender differently. Yeah. And so actually when like going through there are 13 interviews in the book, almost all of them have like gender comes up and masculinity comes up. And many of these guys talk about like not quite fitting in as a boy growing up or like being othered or being kind of an outsider among like groups of boys in a gendered way also. And many of the guys now, as after they've come out, are exploring their gender expression and exploring their masculinity. There's one trans guy in the book. And then there's also one guy who, as of a few years ago, identifies as non-binary and more, even more that are starting to express themselves in ways that are not traditionally masculine and like, you know, wear nail polish or like do things that present differently. So there, you know, once you kind of break the mold and step out of the box in one area, it then you realize, oh, this is kind of good. The world didn't end and I can subvert these expectations and actually it feels authentic and feels like me, and the positives outweigh the fear of like being different. But but all of that is present in like all of these guys.
It's like a queer Pandora's box.
Yeah. There's one specific, like, it's literally just a sentence that you write, which is bisexuality is about the possibility of anything. Standalone. And I was like, oh my god, that's a mantra to take with you for everything. Right, once you start questioning your own attraction to different genders and understanding why that might be, then you can't take your own gender expression for granted.
Yeah.
I also think there's probably the lazy thing to assume, right, would be that the on the Kinsey scale or one of those scales, that the bi men that end up married to women must be less leaning, they must lean less towards homosexuality or men than the bi men that are out. I imagine your anecdotal evidence is a bit different, but I wondered if you want to speak about that.
It's interesting. It's a really interesting question. I wonder that too. And yeah, so what you see in like data is that when you ask people to rate themselves on the Kinsey scale, there's a lot more bisexuality than people realize, but like a big percentage of it is clustered around one and two on the Kinsey scale. So like closer, zero would be completely heterosexual. Six is completely homosexual. Three is like in the middle. And the majority of people in the middle are at the one and two, not like at a three or a four. Mm-hmm. So I think, I mean, the statistics vary, but it's like, that's where they're clustered there. And so, you know, are they a little more on the straight side? Are they more attracted to women? That's what they're self-reporting. So like, I believe that. But then at the same time, we live in a world with huge societal homophobia. And so like, if there were no such thing as homophobia, would everyone be clustered around one and two? Or would it be closer to the middle? Like, I don't know. It could be, it's hard to say because there just is so much homophobia. And so like a lot of these guys, they identify that way. And in my book, I think there are some people at a three or a four, but I do think many of them are at a one or two, and it kind of makes sense because they are married to women. And so a lot of what I hear from this kind of group is like, I'm more romantically attracted to women, but I'm sexually attracted to both. That's a very common thing I've heard from the group in my book, and also from society. Does that also stem a little bit from homophobia and wanting to end up with a partner of the opposite gender who you can have biological babies with? Like, or is that really important to people? I don't know. I don't know if it's the cart before the horse, but that's sort of where the landscape is at the moment, is like, there are a lot of bi guys who lean toward wanting to marry a woman.
Yeah.
But still have these other interests and fantasies, and their sexuality is fluid. So that, I forget what question you asked, but that's sort of like what I observed, but I don't exactly know why that is or which is coming first, you know?
And does that map onto your own personal experience, or is that different?
It's interesting. Like, that's sort of where I started out, and how I approached it was like, I still thought when I came out, like, I'm more romantically interested in women, but I want to explore sexually with anyone. Then I started, like, once I started having sex with men, I realized, oh, I also have emotional connections with men, and oh, I can also date men and have romantic connections with them. So like, I did sort of slowly open myself up to more, and then start to realize how much gender doesn't play a factor, you know, how gender isn't as important as I thought it was on the romantic spectrum either. I guess like I still have dated, I don't know, I still sort of tend to date more women. And I mean, really, like, there was my wife, when we met, she's trans and has transitioned since we met. So like, at first when we met, I was like, oh, I guess I can have romantic connections with a guy. But it turns out that was like, that she's a woman. And so like, I don't know if this reinforces what I was thinking or subverts it. At first I was like, oh, anything's possible. And I guess being with someone who transitions also has helped me see like, oh, it's really about this person. And as her gender has transitioned, like, my feelings haven't changed about her, or about what our connection is. So like, I don't know. It's sort of mirrored my experience, but I've also felt like I've opened myself up to much more, little by little. And I do feel now like anything is possible. Sometimes I don't even know which, do I lean one way or another? I don't know. I feel like anything's possible. It's just like, is about the person and the randomness. And I don't know, you know, I don't know what could happen.
Because that's the other thing, right? On those scales, the past, present, ideal one, I guess, has a bit of this in it. But but your ideal also changes through your life. Like, I had a question about like the marriage focus of it, which is like, what was the decision to focus on marriage as opposed to, for example, like a long-term relationship? Like, what do you think the difference is? Is there for you, or maybe for people in those relationships?
Yeah, interesting question. I almost didn't even really think about that when I started. I was just like, a lot of married guys are writing to me, so let me like interview some married guys. And there's one guy in the book who was in sort of a long-term relationship with two women, but they didn't really get married. They didn't get married. But I think that actually, like, that's another interesting topic that I want to explore, is like people in long-term relationships who are not married, many of whom I think are non-monogamous or poly, especially in the bi and queer community, because like that's happening more and more, of like wanting to be together and making a commitment to someone but not doing the legal marriage thing for various reasons. And so that is something I would like to explore more. But I think the reason like I ended up interviewing married people is because A, that's like sort of who was reaching out to me. And I think that's like what's hard about their experience. And what's interesting about that experience is like that they are married and committed and in this sort of traditional social structure of marriage. And yet also there's queerness in their life. And that sort of comes up against the traditional marriage. And like, that's kind of what I wanted to explore, is these people who in most outward presenting areas of life are following these societal traditions, but how are they subverting it with queerness? And so I would like to do more of what you're talking about in the future. And I think you would sort of have a lot, even more breaking of traditions and diversity, like, and probably polyamory and non-monogamy. I want to write a book about polyamory. That's sort of where my head's going next. But yeah, that's why I started here, is because like, just like, I think it's so underexplored of the married and queer experience.
Yeah. I've got a really quite, this is maybe like a nosy question now, so you don't have to ask it if you don't, but I know that, well, in the introduction, you said that you and your wife are open poly while you were writing the, at least at the time of writing, or like open to it.
Yep.
And I'm thinking, wow, so they decided to get married not that long ago, and now they're deciding to open. I was like, why? I guess I was like, why? I wonder what the draw was to marriage, because a lot of what I assume that what draws people to marriage is not non-monogamy. So sometimes when people do it like 6 years later, I'm like, yeah, I guess you exhausted your time as a monogamous married couple. But I was really interested about how you two decided that, and what it gives you, maybe, like what it meant and means.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we got married while I was working on this project and while I was writing this book. And so it was like, I was thinking a lot about like, what does marriage mean and why do we want to get married? And like, the truth is, so we were already poly before that. I mean, we were monogamous at times in our relationship, especially in the pandemic when we were very isolated. Then we kind of opened things back up as the world opened back up. But really, like, I think that we probably wouldn't have gotten married yet. We would still be together when we're still happy together in this poly relationship. But we really needed like protections of marriage, like the institutional protections. Like, my wife is from China. Her visa was running out. We were worried she wasn't going to be able to stay in the country and work and be able to live here and work. So she needed a green card and she got it and she can work now and is working. And like at the time it was Trump and like she's from China and there was a travel ban and we were worried if she ever went and visited, she wouldn't be able to get back here or something like that. We also like were, our health insurance situation was not great at the time in the pandemic and we wanted her to get on my health insurance. So like there were really practical reasons we did it. And at the same time, what we talked about was like, we are really committed to each other. We don't know what form our relationship will take. We don't know if it will like look the same as most people's traditional marriages, especially since we're poly. But we like really did kind of think about it and want to make a commitment to each other. And we love each other. And like, whatever that looks like, we want to be in each other's lives. So it was a little bit of like both, you know, for safety and protection and all, and like also for love, but it wasn't a traditional marriage. It was in Central Park with 20 of our friends at the last minute. and we don't know, you know, we don't know if we're having kids together yet. We don't. There's a lot of things we still don't know that many people know when they get married. And so, like, our marriage won't look like all the ones in my book necessarily, but you know, none of them look the same as each other. So we're writing our own story.
Ah, so nice. Well, you know, congratulations. Also, smart. Sounds like a smart move. A smart move and a lovely move.
I think
move.
So.
It's also, yeah, I mean, you know, we've spoken about this on the podcast before, the level to which marriage does protect you from so much. And that is bleak. It's dark. It's dark. You could be fearing, like, personal freedoms and, like, the repercussions of, you know, the consequences of not doing it is, like,
right.
Bleak, isn't it?
That's but crazy. It's
kind of, yeah. Yeah.
I'm really glad.
Yeah. No, it was kind of frustrating to be in a position where, like, if we don't do that, if we do nothing, something bad could happen to us. We could be split up because of the government. And like they would have this control over our whether or not we're together. And we were just like, we don't want that. We want to be in control of our relationship. And like, so we have to get married to do that. So we did. But it was kind of scary at the time of like, wow, all these things could, if we just do nothing, all these bad things could happen that are out of our control. It is kind of fucked up.
Yeah, that is fucked up.
Yeah, talk about it. Yeah. there's something really beautiful about the fact that you, so am I right in saying that all the people you interviewed are listeners to your podcast?
Yeah, I mean, for some of the second round of interviews, I put out a call on social media. So it's possible some of them weren't. But I think in the end, everyone had either listened to some or started to listen or, yeah.
So there's something really beautiful about when you write about that in the intro. I was just like, it made me visualize like this invisible community, as you describe, who communicate with each other, not by literally seeing each other, but by like listening to each other. I think that's really beautiful. I guess our question is, why make that step to make it a book as opposed to just doing the podcast? Because like, I guess we've been reflecting recently on why we make a podcast, and community is like the main thing that comes up for us. But what's the merit of making that step to turn it into a book?
Yeah, that's a good question. And like, you know, I did the first round of interviews not knowing what it was going to be. Is it a book? Is it a podcast series? Is it like an audio thing? And then I kind of sat on the interviews for like over a year, not knowing what to do with it and asking myself that question, like, what is this? What's the best form of this? And so I love doing the podcast, and I do think that you hear people's voices, you really get to know them in a different way. Like, and so something I have done is some of the guys in the book agreed to come on the podcast afterwards. The book is more anonymous, and the podcast, they then, you know, were sharing their real voice. And I think seven of them decided to do that. And so they're on my podcast. You can listen to their voice and also read their chapter. But I think I wanted to do it as a book to really just like, A, to reach more people in a different way who might not listen to podcasts, but are open to sort of reading a book. And I also wanted to, you know, also just give an experience of letting people filter it through their head. So like, I do think there's value in hearing people's voices, but I also think there's value in reading stuff and hearing it however you need to hear it, and just reading the words without getting caught up in anything else that comes with the sound of someone's voice. So there's like, maybe when you're reading it, a little more personal connection, or you can view it whichever way works for you in your head to a certain extent. I also wanted it to sort of like live longer in a way than like the podcast is great. And hopefully it's around forever for people to listen to. But I wanted to sort of immortalize these stories in a way and kind of give them like, do a snapshot in time of like, what were these marriages like at this moment? I don't think it'll answer every question in the future about queerness, but like, this is what these marriages were like in this moment. Almost like a, it's not a scientific study, but like something approximating a sociological study, and to give you people like a snapshot. So I don't know. And I also just kept looking at the interviews and thinking and reading the transcripts and thinking like, this could be a book. I don't know why. I don't totally know why, but those are some reasons.
Yeah, it's a difficult question because that's a question not really about bisexuality, but about form. And like you could ask anything. Like we interview people and then we make theater shows out of it sometimes.
Yeah.
And like I have a compilation of like my favorite lyrics published by the songwriter. Like what is, I guess there's something like indelible about it. It's like it's like a Bible, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, and there were so many books that helped me on my journey that like were just different than a podcast or a YouTube thing. Like when I had the book, it just felt like this is real in a way, indelible. Yeah, but yeah. I did think in my head for a while, like, is this a play? Is this like six people on stage acting out these characters? And maybe it is someday. But I just think like part of it was, let it not just be a podcast. Let me do something else. Let's do different forms, different mediums. Like the more various things we're doing, all of us in the community, the better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We need it everywhere.
Hey, listener. You know what I'm going to bring up. This is the point in the show where we mention that we have a Patreon, and we literally wouldn't be able to make this podcast without our Patreon supporters. We're really, really grateful to everyone who gives us a bit of money each month to get these episodes out. It basically means that anyone who can't afford to be a Patreon supporter gets to still listen to the podcast for free, and that's really important to us. It also means that we're not sponsored, so you don't get annoying adverts, and we're allowed to talk about whatever we want without, you know, any sponsors telling us what to do.
You can support us at patreon.com/lifeofbi.
Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, how did you set about choosing who you would include in the book? Like, what were you, presumably you were looking for like a diverse range of stories, but like,
yeah,
did you notice which stories jumped out to you most?
It was about finding like a diverse range of voices, and so they were all like sort of different, not just in race or religion or like identity, but also in like what was their story and what was going on in their marriage, just to like, I wanted to show a range of different things. And I guess I probably gravitated towards like things that I was interested in and things that like were difficult for people. Like, I think when people wrote in, you know, I'm married and bi and I came out to my wife and like everything's great, I there are a couple of those in the book. I wanted to include that, but I also was like, when people said this thing has been hard for us, or we're working on opening up our marriage, or everything's great with my wife, but I'm struggling to find bi community. I wanted to sort of recruit those people and touch on those things of like both the joyful stuff and the good stuff, and also like, what are you struggling with?
Yeah, so I think it's probably good that the book just isn't all like success stories.
Yeah, imagine. You'd be reading it like
you'd be like, okay, great, I really don't know any more about this or feel more
in
seen.
In fact, like, I don't have a question related to this, but I've highlighted like one of the last sentences in the introduction, which is, relationships are really fucking hard, but they're also immeasurably beautiful, sometimes especially when they're hard. A concept that bi plus people who have experience with duality and accepting seemingly contradictory ideas should have a unique ability to understand. That makes me feel so seen.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not a bi-married man, but I have those difficulties, and
yeah,
I feel deeply existential. And I think it's beautiful to position the bisexual person reading it as like the perfect person to be able to solve that for themselves, or not even solve, just to hold.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, to that sentence, I needed it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And well, I think that something this book taught me, and I've learned in therapy and on the podcast over the last few years, is like, there's this dominant idea that like, if a relationship is too hard, it's not the right relationship, or it's bad, or like, you know, relationships should be easy. And like, I think to a certain extent, yes, a relationship shouldn't be like a nightmare, and it shouldn't be a constant struggle. That's difficult too. But at the same time, like, what, I don't know, what relationship is super easy? If it's easy, are you really working? Like, are you really honest with each other and working on stuff? Like, I almost can't imagine it being like that easy, because there's two people are different, and there's so many things that come up. And like, we're often trained to think like, if stuff is too hard, it's you may not be right for each other. And another thing I learned from this book of is that like, what is success and failure in a relationship? And like, that success, we're told, means you stay together forever until one of you dies. And like, there's a couple in this book, there's a few couples, but there's one I'm thinking of where like, they ended their marriage while we were working on the book. And that was what they were very afraid of. And yet afterwards, they both are like, they don't regret it. They're happier. They realize it was the right decision. And they have so much love between them still. They're still friends. They still work on a business together. They're still co-parenting three like mostly grown kids. And they have more love for each other now than when they were married in a way. And like, they consider their marriage a success, even though it ended. And especially because in the last few years, they were able to be more honest with each other than ever. That improved their relationship, even though their marriage ended. And it's like, it's counterintuitive to most people, especially straight people, but it like, it makes sense to me. It's like, so many people stay in a marriage that isn't authentic, and they can't express themselves, and they think that's success because they're still together.
I guess that's why lots of people in the poly community can particularly start using the word transition, relationship transition, because it just opens up the fact that like, there's an ending and a beginning in it, but you're not ending you can't end a relationship with someone even if you never saw them again, because they'd still be in your head and your heart and your, do you know what I mean? That like we can't do that, unfortunately. Heartbreak would be a lot easier if we could, but you can't.
I think that the term break up, although like used basically universally, is just not accurate in most cases.
No, it's not a breakup.
Yeah.
As in, ideally you haven't broken anything. Ideally,
in fact it might be way more healing than the term suggests.
I was gonna say something about
I love that idea about transitioning. I love that word because that's what happens most of the time, is the relationship transitions into something else, right? I think also
there's a sort of a traditionalist argument about marriage, which is that's why you should do it, right? Which is that you when you encounter difficulty, you have to get through it. And there's a potentially like really beautiful version of that if you are actually dealing with difficulties and moving through conflict. But there's the other side of that, which is just like, we've just got to flow over our differences rather than like have them.
Yeah,
that's fascinating. And it just reminds me of many of the guys in my book, in that like, some of them are really able to like talk through anything that's on their mind with their partners. Maybe that was difficult for them before they came out as bi, and then it starts to like get easier. But those tend to be the couples that are together. And like, there were some who they couldn't fully express themselves, or they couldn't say everything that's on their mind, or they acknowledge that there are certain things in their relationship that are like, don't ask, don't tell. I think that is difficult to repair stuff when you're not saying everything, right? Because things can seem repaired, but not actually be repaired. And it takes hard work and difficult conversations to do that. And so, yeah, you definitely see some of that in the book of who can go there and who is still a little afraid of going there.
Mm. Are you curious, or would you want to talk to bi married women? Do you think it would be very different, or?
I would love to. I would love to even partner with a married woman to sort of do those interviews and write the book. Although I mean, I could do it myself, but it's not my experience. So I would feel a little, I don't want to represent other people's experiences for them, but I would love to. And I would imagine that a lot of things in my book come up also, that there would be probably a huge crossover of certain topics. I bet at the same time there would be unique ones because the experience can be different. And it's bi women maybe are more less stigmatized for their same-sex attractions, but more fetishized or more seen as something that is not accurate, even if it's with a more positive look. There's other unique things that come up for bi women. And so I think it would be a lot the same, but also there would be unique stuff. And I would love to explore that. And that we've explored it on the podcast, and I probably have more women on my podcast than men these days. But yeah, the married experience, I hope we can do that. Rutledge, my publisher, has a book about bi married women already. I forget what it's called, but I think it has bi married women in the title, which is part of how I got my book deal. Cause they were like, oh, we have the bi married women book. We would love the bi married men book.
I think I've read that. I've read bits of that book.
Have you?
I'm sure.
Yeah. My book is not exactly the same as theirs, but it's a good compliment. You know, theirs is very much about bi married women, and mine is about bi married men.
Yeah. Cause you, I think this is purely anecdotal. None of us are scientists here necessarily, but we've interviewed enough people, done some reading. I think we would also assume, right, that because of androcentrism, it's going to be more if a guy comes out to his wife as bi, that's going to be treated as quite a big deal. Whereas I feel if a bi married woman said, I'm bi, the problem would actually be it seeming a complete non anything.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's and this is
right.
Actually.
Yeah. It's something I actually want to do. Yeah. I'm not just saying it but this, I'd be really interested to know how a couple navigates that thing, which is the woman having to be no, I am bi and I do want to do this thing. And it's not some schoolgirl hangover I've got.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'd be really interested also how that crosses over with poly because of the classic sort of one dick rule. You know, you can get into stuff where often the cis guy in these scenarios is doesn't credit the other AFAB people that their wife is sleeping with as being potency. enough to overturn the thing. Yeah. So the external threat is not perceived.
Yeah.
right.
So the threat is not perceived. I'm really fascinated. We've got to read that book.
You know what? You know, I also want another book that I've just thought of, which is about straight men in relationships with bisexual women, because there are some men, and I know this because my partner is one of them, who for some accident of the universe has only ever been out with bisexual women. Every woman he's ever dated is bi. And I'm
interesting.
What is it about you that is seeking that queer energy without even realizing?
Yeah.
Or are there people who specifically, and I'm what? So where does that put you in the queer spectrum? Because there's something queer going on.
right. I mean, honestly, it sounds like me. I dated only cis women for a long period of my life. I didn't know I was bi. I wasn't looking for bi. I didn't even know bi was a thing. But it turns out a lot of people I've dated have since come out as bi or as trans or non-binary. I was into people who were not totally conforming in some way without realizing it. And so that, I don't know that that's your partner. It eventually led me to realize that.
You're giving me dangerous hope.
Yeah, he may be straight. I'm sorry, he may be straight, but there's something, there could be something there.
It's food for thought, you know?
It's fascinating what that means. So, like, I haven't, like, transitioned with while I've been in this relationship, but I have gone from using she, her pronouns to using they, them pronouns. And, like, the way I present myself has actually changed quite radically, whether or not I've, like, I'm not taking hormones or made any surgical changes to my body, but... even within that realm of experimentation, it is interesting. There is this sort of like fun tease where you're like, you still like me now? Okay, you still like me now? Okay, just so that means that maybe you, so what do you like then? What is it that you like about this more mask energy? Like, it's fascinating that that move and how one, how two people, you know, none of us are an island. Sexuality, we are affected by the people around us, and you can be sort of, not like influence, but parts of you can be brought out that you might not have
someone else's
fluidity. Like, you have to be fluid in order to stay together.
Right. I mean, and I know a couple, I mean, I'm married to a trans person, but I know a couple straight identified men who are married or in a relationship with someone assigned female birth who is exploring their gender or identifying as non-binary, or, you know, and it's, and it is like, I sometimes I want to ask them, and no, maybe I should interview these guys, of like, what does this mean to you? What do you think of this? Like, how does this affect your straightness? Like, what if this partner did fully transition and identify as a guy? Like, what would that mean for you? I wonder, I, it's interesting. What would people say and how do they think about it? Cause like they're, if they love the person, then they'll may, it may bring out queerness in them. Or if they are so, you know, locked into straightness, then like, is that really gonna change or transition the relationship? Maybe. And that's a, it's a fascinating topic.
Yeah, it's like, you know, that one of the amazing stats in the intro is the stat about what's the name for the generation below us?
Gen Z.
I was like, what's that? You know, the TikTok people. The statistics of how many of those identify like not in the 0 or 6 of the Kinsey scale.
Yeah,
and like as people keep questioning themselves and their identity, there's I think the stat that you said is that like
it doubles
something generation. About doubles
every generation, it's doubling of queer like, identified people
essentially doubling with every generation. I'm like
so exciting.
It can only double so many times before it reaches everyone, you know. We're almost to the point where like it can't double anymore because it's so high. Like I think among the really young, like 18 to 24 year olds, I think there's a stat, I think it's from the UK, where like half of them identify as not straight on the Kinsey scale. Half.
Al from the future here. The statistic that Rob is referring to here is in the recent Gallup poll on LGBT plus identification. In 2021, 57% of the LGBT plus community self-identified as bisexual, compared to 21% who identified as gay, 14% as lesbian, 10% as transgender, and 4% as something else. Rob uses this poll to look at generational trends in queerness. So traditionalists born before 1946, 0.8% of people identify as LGBT+. For baby boomers, it goes up to 2.6%. For Gen X, it goes up to 4.2%. Millennials, it jumps again to 10.5%. And a whopping 20.8% of Gen Zs identify as queer. So the number of queer people is essentially doubling with energy with every generation.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's like, it makes total sense to me, but
yeah.
Fascinating. Yeah. We also did some looking at in a previous series of our podcast, looked at sort of by TikTok, which is fascinating. Gen Z is the sort of like, we did a sort of whole episode on how they have this like, insanely what seems to us precocious understanding of like language and labels, but they're still teenagers. They still come up against these like quite basic problems. So just like come to like quite like crass conclusions. You're like, no, that's not what you should conclude. But
interesting.
It's this really funny combination of what seems mature, but what one generation thinks of as mature because of like where, how long it, what language they had at different points. Like I didn't know, bisexual. I felt like I knew quite late and stuff. So the idea that these young people know it so early, are using it so early, no pad, no trans. It's like, it's mind blowing, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't realize it was a real thing until a lot later. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I didn't know. I mean, even when I knew the word, I didn't know real people who identified that way until a lot later. Yeah.
Are there any like final?
Do you have any questions for us?
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you guys think is like the next level of like bi activism or discussion? Like, I feel like sometimes I get caught in the same thing of like either the label wars or like busting bi stereotypes or like, and sometimes I wonder like, what's next? If the next generation is more open-minded and bi aware and friendly, like what would you want to see in this, in the bi podcast activism space? I don't know. Is that a real question? It's very nebulous.
That's a great question. It's a hard question.
I think it'd be, I mean, it's where those hotspots are where there's, you can sort of still feel, I'm actually mainly thinking from the queer community, prejudice or tension, which I don't know if this would be, I mean, this is, I guess, more about gender, but like thinking about the resistance that I have, I can notice it in myself and I can see it around me sometimes. For instance, like a cis woman dating, or maybe like a queer woman dating a AMAB, a non-binary AMAB who actually walks around with all the appearance of masculinity. So there's nothing visual to tell you that that person is non-binary, because of, I think, that frontier of like how we understand of queerness as struggle. And so the idea of someone having the identity non-binary, but moving through the world with perceived the as a cis man of, constantly is quite like, we still have stuff around it because of this struggle narrative, which gets, you know, that struggle narrative gets, I'm happy to say, not obviously in all areas of queerness, but with each generation, it gets a bit looser. Like there's less struggle around, but there's still this holding on to what that means. And there's sort of like gatekeepiness around what everyone actually hoped for when these gender, when these revolutions start, the idea that it's without ever, you know,
which is what funny.
Is what the hope is, but then each little growth spurt, people are like,
it's funny because you've essentially outlined, but in your own like 2024 angle, non-binary angle, you've essentially outlined exactly what TERFs feel.
Yeah.
Right? Like literally in those exact words, basically. They perceive someone who walks around with the privileges of of certain people. And so there, I think there will be a time where the likes of us making this content, and like we will have to be challenged, you know, and part of our responsibility is to not be like those, the TERFs of the day who shut down that like progress, but to like be soft and welcoming with like as welcoming as we are to people calling themselves bisexual now, you know.
I
think that would be
that is really interesting. And it kind of just makes me think about like how as the numbers of queer people are growing and the percentages get bigger, like it then becomes easier to be queer because you see yourself and you feel more normal and there's less stigma. And like, I don't know if like we'll ever be the majority. If queerness is the majority, is it queer anymore? Like, what is queerness if it's not the alternative culture to the dominant culture? But like, if sexual and gender fluidity become the norm, then it is like, you know, then it could actually become the struggle to not identify with fluidity, and what does that do? And right, like, then if queerness is ever sort of the dominant thing, what does that mean for us? How does it change what queerness is and how we look at straight people and cis people, and like, how, right, how do we like invite them in still? It's very complicated and interesting.
Particularly because, like, you know, we're operating with this word pride, but the word pride's got a lot of ego in it. And actually, for the growth of queerness to a point where maybe it's not even something that identifies you as particularly special, you'd have to let go of ego. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You'd have to let go of the idea of, like, because there being anything massively proud. There's something to be proud about.
Because it's an identity you have to kind of hold on to quite fiercely, right? By nature. And I think our job is going to be to just loosen.
Right. Well, because that's what the young generation, like, they probably grow up not feeling that same way, that they have to hold on to this and that it's very special and it's difficult. And like, for me, yeah, once I realized it, I was like, yes, hold on to that. Like, this makes everything make sense and it feels great. And like, I love this community. But if you grow up with that as the norm, like, that's great. That's the world we want. But yeah, they may not feel the same way about holding on to these identities and celebrating them. They may just feel like, yeah, this is normal. Why? How was it ever not normal? And like,
yeah. And we'll be like, we fought for that, you know?
Yeah, in some ways, actually.
Each generation feels they have ownership of that because they fought for it, you know?
right.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
I love to see it, what's happening. And then it's like, okay, if all this stuff is normalized for Gen Alpha, that's the even next one, then what will they fight for? Like, what still won't be right for them, and what will they fight for? I don't even know, and I'm curious to find out.
Yeah.
Well, what a note to leave the interview on.
Yeah.
This has been a joy, Rob.
Yeah, Rob, honestly. Yeah. Monday evening vibes here. We were like, oh, we're a bit tired. This has been so invigorating, and it's so nice to meet you.
Yeah, me too. It's really nice to meet you. It's my Monday morning, so now I get to take this excitement and energy into my day. I'm glad we made this happen. Thank you so much. This was really a fun conversation.
Life of Bi was made, edited, and hosted by us, Elle Potter and Mary Higgins.
Sound design and production by Tom Foskett Barnes.
This podcast is supported by you, the listener.
Big thank you to our latest Patreons, Matari, Rosa, Gabriella, Alexandra, Petta, Eden, Steph, and Sam.
Like them, you can support us at patreon.com/lifeofbi.
Thanks for listening.
I just want to say, it ain't over till the bisexual speak.